Some Massachusetts hospitals have proven particularly effective at avoiding the spread of COVID-19. So what can we learn from them as we approach our statewide reopening? Dr. Atul Gawande says quite a bit. He's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and Harvard Medical School. He's also the former CEO of Haven Healthcare and now chairman of Haven's board and a staff writer for The New Yorker. He recently wrote about how our reentry can be modeled after what's being done in hospitals, and he joined us earlier today to talk about that approach.
Making it so hospitals were not sites of spread is an enormous amount of work, and you have to understand all the basics. At this point, everybody knows about them. It's about hygiene, distancing, screening for symptoms, and masks. Each of them have flaws. You skip one, it doesn't work. But taken together, and if you take them seriously, they've been able to shut down the virus.
So could you walk us through, like practically, you arrive at work in the morning, how a period of, let's say, 2 or 3 hours manifests across all of those categories of prevention?
Yeah. So first, when I arrive, right away we have a dispenser for hand sanitizer. And, you know, that's important. One thing about just hand washing that people may not recognize, more is better. Studies have shown that when you wash 10 times or more per day, that's when you get less. You get half of the infection rate. Now, what does that mean? That means anytime you enter into a high-traffic environment, or exit a high-traffic environment, then you want to wash hands or hand sanitize. You also, every 2 to 3 hours when you're in that environment with people, any group setting, you want to be washing your hands and then, of course, disinfecting the surfaces. Now, that's just about 5 to 10% of spread is from surfaces and your hands. Most is airborne. That's where distancing comes in, and we have the 6-foot distancing at work. The escalators, elevators, all of those things. We also know it's not enough. So the other...
Yeah, that's a little discouraging.
It is. Look, we have hundreds of thousands of people right now who are infected, and most have no symptoms yet. And that's why lockdown works, is we're just avoiding those people. At work, we can't avoid them. And it's actually less about the patients. It's about us. The patients are isolated. They're in their rooms. They're not coming and going. We, the workers, are coming and going, and that means we have to have additional elements. The two big additional elements, one is screening.
How does the screening work in your workplace?
Yeah, so we have a website, and on my phone, I've bookmarked it. I go to it every day when I go into the hospital at the Brigham. I screen. There's a bunch of symptom questions. I have to confirm I have none of those symptoms. And then I get a green pass that lets me walk in the door. There's someone checking for passes at all the main entrances, and then I can go into work. And that's critical. So, you know, we have, believe it or not, you know, the Mass General Brigham system has 75,000 employees. That's more than 75% of U.S. counties, and yet we've controlled this, right? And 50,000 of us showed up at work last month. So we're making the system work for all of us.
I do want to time out right there for a second, because I hear you, and I hear you loud and clear, and it's clearly been effective. Two things run through my mind. The first is, these are medical workers who are used to a different level of compliance and a different level of expectation. And second, are there civil liberty issues with, I'm not allowed into a building until I give my health information and get a green pass?
What they've got to know is, am I green or am I red for coming into work? So from the civil liberties point of view, perfectly okay, and it's been confirmed also against the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, the irony is that we as healthcare workers are not great about, our culture has been that you go to work no matter what. It's embarrassing, but it's true. Like, we've traditionally seen it as a sign of weakness that you take a sick day. And here is a complete change in our culture that's been required, so that if you even have the hint of a cold, that, you know, your job is not to infect other people, that your job is to stay home. And that's been hard, right? Over the last 5 weeks, out of all of the 50,000 people who show up, 11,000 people have had symptoms, stayed home, and got tested. 1,400 of them turned out to be positive. And if we hadn't caught those, they wouldn't have stayed home, and then they would have been at risk of infecting others.
Yeah, and I want to stay on that for a minute, too, because your article really did emphasize this requirement of cultural change and also not going into work if you're showing symptoms. So let's go in reverse order, because that raises two questions. The first, one of the symptoms that you talk about is like runny nose. I keep thinking about allergy season and other basic things like that. Is it practical or desirable to keep people out of work for things like seasonal allergies because we just can't tell the difference?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's new symptoms, so people with seasonal allergies will have runny nose the entire, you know, spring.
Got it.
And so we're looking for those allergies, those things where it's new symptoms. That said, look, 90% of the time, this is just a cold or nothing. But 10% of the time, actually, you know, what I just told you with the statistics, it's about 15% that are turning out to have the virus when you have these really mild symptoms.
So that does bring up then the culture change question that I had. And it's a little bit complex, but we've done some call-ins on our program in the last couple of weeks, for example, around people wearing masks and questions about how do you get other people to wear them? And do you use shaming or do you use encouragement? And what drives that cultural change? I noticed in your article, you talked about people who have for years worked in this tough it out culture in healthcare. And you referred to that at the end of one paragraph as now that would be seen as showing shameful disloyalty. And I do wonder, what do we know about what incentivizes culture change? Is it a shaming-based approach? Is it an incentives-based approach? Is it a we're-all-in-it-together approach? What is going to work for the broader general public in getting people to share these behaviors that you're arguing are so fundamental to being able to safely reenter the economy?
Yeah, this is so critical because it turns out to be the fifth crucial pillar, which is the culture of keeping one another safe. It's critically about I protect you, you protect me. Our discussion in our culture right now is only about two values, safety and freedom. Keep me safe, leave me alone. The culture of the hospital that we've had to create, it's taking the culture of the operating room and bringing out to the hospital, and now we're trying to bring it out everywhere. And that's about never wanting to be the one to infect someone else, never wanting to be the one to put somebody in the morgue. And we're not vigilantes about it. That doesn't work. It doesn't work to scream at people. It's about the idea that we're in this together and that you can then say, hey, dude, your mask is down. And then they say, thanks. Or that you say to yourself, I got a cold coming on. I really don't want to be that person who could hurt somebody at work. We have to work at that. You have to find leaders and,
it does
and
sound
you have
hard.
To communicate it. And we have to communicate at the top level. It does not help that we have a president who's embarrassed to wear a mask, who does not want to communicate that, you know, we're in this together and that you can't do this. So it's up to the rest of us.
None of this is necessarily new, these steps, but there's a level of commitment and compliance that you're talking about. There are mental and social-emotional well-being impacts of embracing that as a truly new normal. How do you think about that as a physician?
Well, I think we have shown that we can do it with something that's enormously more disruptive and mentally disturbing for many people, which is locking yourself down in your house, right? This is taking that one step that allows us to actually get connected and re-enter. It isn't about being perfect. None of these steps are perfect, but you put them together at a decent level of effectiveness.
All right, before we let you go, just this week you stepped down as CEO of Haven Healthcare, which was a joint venture between Amazon, JP Morgan Chase, Berkshire Hathaway. We said before, you will remain as chairman of Haven's board. What led you to this decision?
Well, partly it's where we are. This is an opportunity. We've got amazing people, and I've been able to move away from day-to-day management and shifting to greater focus on our overall vision and strategy. I'm very much staying involved. But it's also about finding that there's an opportunity then to be involved externally. As the CEO driving operations every day in and out, I had stepped back from being involved publicly. I'd not been writing at all for 18 months and not been involved in policy and public health in the same way, and I was happy to do that. The pandemic hit, and we reached a place where I felt the need to be stepping out publicly as well as continuing, and this was a win-win, a way that all of it could happen.
How would you characterize the company's progress or success at this point? And will it have to pivot given this new normal that we're talking about?
Our job is focusing on our population of more than 1 million workers first, and we're making progress on solutions for better care and costs. But no question, COVID-19 is the most radical disruption of health and the healthcare system since at least World War II. I mean, right now, there's critical infrastructure in healthcare at risk, starting with the basic foundation of primary care, with large numbers of primary care physicians not being able to have enough income to keep their doors open. And we're not going to solve COVID-19, let alone improve the health of the country, if we're not able to address those larger healthcare issues. And there are dimensions here that absolutely require private sector involvement and innovation, like I get to be involved with Haven, but there's a lot more that also involves policy and leadership at broader levels.
Last question for you, Atul. You have experience at all levels of our healthcare infrastructure. Based on what you're seeing, do you see significant gaps, especially at the federal level, where you have a lot of experience, that we are going to need to address in that infrastructure?
Without question. This is a big opportunity. We have all experienced now moving 70 to 80% of practice into a virtual environment. We have to have a sustainable way to maintain that, and I think that's a big opportunity. We have to be able to use it so that it actually improves people's outcomes and care, and that it's not clear we're yet progressing to the place where we know how to do that. And then lastly, we have big parts of our specialty infrastructure that are in real danger. You have 70 to 80% of ophthalmologists and ear, nose, and throat clinicians, surgeons, who their practices have been completely shut down, and we need to have ways that can continue.
That's Dr. Atul Gawande. He's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Medical School. He's also the former CEO of Haven Healthcare and now chairman of Haven's board and a staff writer for The New Yorker. We spoke with him earlier today.